on the phone with Kate Griffiths, who is the Executive Director of Recourse Mediation Services, a community-based mediation. It sounds like from our conversations and what you've described is that you offer an array of different services, and being community-based means you work with community groups. Kate?
We do, and we're a non-profit, Dan, so we work with people regardless of how much they can pay. And we do all sorts of things. As you say, we have a contract with the court in Sonoma County, so we do a lot of what they call day of trial mediations. We help people negotiate with each other in civil cases. We also do a lot of family law stuff, a lot of folks who don't want to go through the courts fighting each other when they're getting divorced and they have to work as co-parents with their kids. We also help other government agencies, nonprofits. We work with neighborhood associations, homeowners associations, anybody who must or wants to continue the relationship that they have with the person that they're in conflict with or the group that they're in conflict with, and needs to work out a resolution that's going to be mutually satisfying and meet people's needs. And that's why mediation works, because it's based on meeting people's needs rather than what they think they want.
Great. And for our listeners, Kate Griffiths is joining us on Shift Shapers, Pole Reversal Radio, where we look at what are some of the skills that we're going to need? What are some of the resources that we are going to have really within ourselves and with our new communities as we start to see things become less predictable, so where we start to have this drastic reduction that we're looking at in government services, and drastic reductions in our level, our standard of living, as we go forward with an economy that is just full of ifs, ands, and buts. So that we start getting to a position where the more we can do to create new communities where we can be working with our neighbors and resolving things between ourselves,
right,
the more skill we develop with that, the more we will be able to create really the new communities, instead of just shifting from where things are predictable into like a disaster economy or into shock doctrine or whatever you might want to say, where we're actually shifting into the new community, whatever we make that look like, because that's the adventures that we're actually creating it and making it look like something. And to do that, we got to work together, and to work together, we got to be able to communicate and come to agreements. So that's what's been exciting about my conversations with you, Kate.
Well, and likewise, Dan, I think what we need to do is take our power back as people on the planet. We need to understand that all of this infrastructure that we've created in the Western industrialized cultures, all of the layers of local government and so on, in any stratified society, those things serve a function. But what happens is we create a dependent attitude on them, and we give our power to them. What we do in community mediation is train ordinary residents of a community to be volunteer mediators, because what we want to do is seed the community, the one we have right now, with these kinds of skills, because what we're doing as mediators, we're neutral third parties, we're impartial when we're supporting the negotiation between people who have the shared problem. We're reinvesting those people with the power that they have forgotten that they have. Mm. So it's a very exciting field, actually, to be in, because it's so antithetical to the culture we're in. When people fight with each other, they tend to want a referee. We're very competitive in this culture. We want a winner or a loser. So when people have particularly relationship-based disputes, it's really kind of crazy to take those things to a place like the court.
Right.
Because there's going to be a guaranteed loser.
Yeah.
So what we need to do is retrieve our personal power to create the reality that we want to create. And we do that by really deeply listening to each other, listening to understand, having an openness to settling things. You don't have to become best friends, but you do need to understand that if that relationship's important to you, whether it's a landlord-tenant relationship, an employer-employee relationship, a family, friend, neighbor relationship, whatever it is, the way that it's going to continue to be productive in the future and functional is when we retrieve our power, we take responsibility for our own behavior, we take responsibility to listen and understand, and in this way, I think we're going to create from the ground up a much more inclusive, a much more productive, a much more, a better learning culture. And I don't know, you know, my love of reading, Dan, here. Eric Hoffer is an American philosopher, and I love his quote. He says, in times of drastic change, it's the learners who inherit the future. And what you're saying is that if we don't learn new ways of interacting with each other, we are doomed to fail because we don't know how to do what we need to do. Because if we keep sending our power to people who have power over, we never really understand the power to do something. And that's the shift we need to happen, I think. It's the power to create the realities that we want to live in instead of moaning about the realities that are not functioning anymore.
The power to create the realities that we want to live in rather than complaining about the realities that we really don't want to live under anymore.
Right.
Very good. I love that. And what a great approach to be taking on Shift Shapers.
Yeah, well, because we only have each other, don't we,
to
rely on. We know that as soon as there's an earthquake, and there's a little earthquake this week, a little tiny one that I felt, but it reminded me, we could all have collapsed neighborhoods here very easily if we have a great big situation like the poor Japanese people went through.
Right.
It's who are we going to rely on? We must rely on our neighbors and our friends and the people who are right there when those kinds of disasters happen. And if we don't know how to communicate and connect with those people, our own personal survival and the survival of our neighborhoods and our families and our way of life is threatened, actually, if we don't learn how to do that better.
Right. It's a time when something comes along, like it could be a disaster that happens suddenly and with the blink of an eye, or it could be something that's gradual, like the like something like peak oil, and that things start to become... Actually, very quickly, fuel becomes very expensive, food becomes expensive, things start getting out of hand in that realm, but it happens over time, or in rising unemployment or whatever. I mean, we're looking at where the government is now arguing over whether to default. We've got the International Monetary Fund is disguised as Republicans in Wisconsin and Michigan taking over, you know, kicking people out of government and putting corporations in charge, which is what they do in third world countries. So it's like, I think unpredictability has started to step in a little bit here in the good old U.S. of A.
I think it has. And the trouble with people when they're human beings, when they're in crisis, is they start acting out of the old reptilian brain. We have fear as the big motivator, and we lose our higher consciousness functioning. We tend to be feeling much more like victims. We tend to have of either freezing in the headlights or we have a fight or flight response.
Right.
When we don't actually need to do any of that, what we need to do is understand what works when individuals are in crisis and what works, because what works at the individual level works at the larger level, community level.
And
what works is people really listening to each other, understanding each other, recognizing that we have different values, that we have different ways of looking at the world and different ways of seeing it. But people who refuse to change because the old order has worked for them, those are the folks who are going to find that the new changed circumstances are circumstances for which they have no way of equipping themselves. They have no adaptation to those changed circumstances, and they keep trying to apply the old way, and it won't work. I'm sure anybody who's listening to this has been in a situation where you've tried to get through to somebody, whether in your personal life or in your professional life or wherever, where they are insisting on an old way of doing things, and you can't seem to get through to them that reality doesn't exist anymore.
Right, and we can come up with examples for that as well. I mean, we're looking at a number of them actually. There are people counting on their Social Security checks.
Oh, right.
and we're being told, well, none of this is going to affect the Social Security people who are currently collecting. Oh, okay. So if in 5 years I want to collect Social Security, I won't get it.
Right.
But British Petroleum will get their little cut of the taxes, and Chevron will get their piece, and the people who own stock in all those, they'll get great tax breaks, but I won't get Social Security. Well, things have changed then when that occurs.
Well,
it's a different
exactly
world.
Right. Yeah, exactly right. And if we have some big drastic change that collapses our economic structure the way we know it, this is not the first, that won't be the first time this has happened to human beings in history.
Right.
And we have the same neocortex that people had hundreds, thousands of years ago.
That the Athenians had.
Exactly right. We have the same level, we have the same capacities for creativity and the same capacities for interacting with each other. What happens when one system collapses is another system takes its place. I often think about what happened in the bubonic plague that decimated Europe. I think 2/3 of Europe, their European population at the time, died.
Yeah.
And what happened to the feudal systems, the economic feudal system that was in place at the time, was that the folks, the lords and so on who owned the land, and isn't this exactly what we've got with large corporations?
Yes.
The concentration of wealth that was in the hands of the very few, those folks realized that they couldn't eat their money, and that they had better go out and dig in the soil themselves because all of the peasant labor had died. And the result of this whole thing was that there was an emerging middle class because you had a lot of peasants who could take over land that was either abandoned or that they earned the right to keep because of their work.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got all of these folks out there in their fine robes and jewelry trying to figure out how to use a plow.
Wow.
Because they didn't have any skills. They didn't know how to do that.
Right.
So the folks who are closest to the earth, the people who understand how to cooperate and work together, the people who know how to live within the eternal cycles of life and death, not the people who have a good understanding of global economics, because what if those things collapse? We must
right.
bring it back close. To what keeps us going physically.
True. And you know, when I think about what you were describing about regular people, the peasants, the peasantry taking over parcels of land. To develop them. I think about, like, for instance, in the Excelsior District and Mission District in San Francisco, which are mostly Latino and immigrant population and very low income, is a program that they have in there that recently started an organization called Poder, which means power, has gone in and started a program called Pueblote, where they go and look for, in English they call it ground truthing, where you go in and look over all the lots that aren't being used, particularly the public-owned ones, and start petitioning the local government to take those over for
right.
public gardens and parks
right.
by the community.
Yeah.
So there is a movement for that to actually start happening now.
Well, I think this. I think what's happening because of the way the current systems are wobbling and people are losing faith in them, we're seeing in a way that we haven't seen before how much waste there is. How much waste there is in our culture. I was watching this wonderful film the other day, Dan, about, I don't know if people have seen it, that lovely French movie about four babies, the first year of life of four babies, one in Namibia, one in Mongolia, one in Tokyo, and one in San Francisco. And it's so interesting to see how all of those babies are exactly the same. They all go
all
through
cute.
Exactly the same sorts of things. But the people who, in our culture, we would describe as poor, the Namibians and the Mongolians, We're very rich in community, very rich in just physical touching of the child, connection with animals, of just living in the natural environment.
Mm-hmm. And probably ceremony as well.
Right. They don't need toys because the purpose of the child's first year of life is to orient themselves to the world they're in now and into the human environment that they're in now. So each baby was doing a good job of adapting itself to the culture that it was in. But it's a wordless movie. There is no script or anything like that, and I highly recommend anybody to watch that documentary. It's so interesting to see how we encourage our kids to read in the first year of life. A book.
Yes, that's right.
Because
what's the name of this film again?
It's called Babies.
Babies, okay.
Mm-hmm. But what we need to do, rather than read, is we need to talk. We need face-to-face communication. We need to help very, very young children learn, particularly with the new technologies that there are now. So many of these kids just text all day long, that they're on social networking sites and so on.
Right, right.
My concern as a mediator and as a person who tries to help people improve their face-to-face communication is that there's a lot of skills that are being lost. How do you teach a child to read nonverbal cues, which is absolutely vital for effective interpersonal communication, if they're so used to just texting?
And when you're in ground-shifting situations where, what we're doing is we've got this crop coming in, or we're all going to be doing producing power and figuring out how to generate power for the community because we're having a little trouble getting some, that's going to require some interpersonal communication.
Yes.
And you're not going to have the big grid. You aren't necessarily going to have the big grid for all that texting.
No, you won't. And I'm actually a fan of all of these social networking tools and all of these tools because they're all communication tools. When the telephone was first invented, people thought it was an evil instrument. The reality is that we're a very inventive species, and we're going to come up with new ways to communicate because we're kind of compulsive communicators. It's how we are as social animals.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is that we don't supplant fundamental forms of communication, such as face-to-face communication, with some of these technologies. We need to have them as well. You see what people did in Tunisia and Egypt and so on with social networking tools to help overthrow oppression.
Mm-hmm.
I think these kinds of things are really helpful, but we mustn't abandon more fundamental forms of communication in favor of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's kind of interesting, too, because cultures where they have a rich set of nonverbal cues to communicate with each other tend to be slow to adopt things like the Facebooks and social media and the computers. And I see that evident in the Latino community, particularly people from Mexico, because it's a culture where there's a lot of nonverbal and there's a lot of ways of saying things just through expression and just hand signals and just ways of saying things that you have to actually be looking at a person to be communicating with them thoroughly.
And I also think we underestimate the value of touch in human communication.
Mm.
We, in Anglo-North American kind of a culture, Western industrialized culture, tend to be more cerebral in our communication. We tend to be more information-oriented and less physical. This was what was so interesting about that Babies movie to me. There's so much touching and so much holding and so much physical interaction with the child that communicates much more than any word could or any book could about whether that child is secure, whether that child is in a safe world, all of those kinds of things that we want children to understand.
Mm.
And when we're growing new humans, as we always must do, it's important to say, well, what kind of communication do I want this child in this family to have if you are the person who's parenting a child? You and I are both parents, Dan, and I'm sure our kids have benefited from our individual compulsive communication style.
Oh, yes.
but I do see...
I hear myself every now and then.
But it's a good thing because I feel like young people who do not come from families like that, who communicate largely by... So many parents keep in touch now with their kids with texting. Or I have a friend who can keep track of her adult children only through Facebook. She can't seem to get them to visit.
Uh-huh.
So I just feel as though if we're going to create new communities, the family, wherever children are being raised, is always the genesis of the community. You don't what we tend to do in our culture is have silos of community. So we have the Latino community, we have the Eritrean community, we have this community and that community.
Right.
And my concern is that there's not enough cross-pollination, there's not enough understanding or appreciation of each other's lens through which life is lived and experienced and viewed.
Right, and that doesn't necessarily mean, I'm not hearing you say that it's all about assimilation or our concept of assimilation. It's actually that you can actually respect and try to understand somebody's, where someone's coming from culturally, just with and worldview and everything.
Right. And this is where, in my experience as a mediator, when I see people really stuck in intractable conflicts, what often is at the heart of it is a values clash.
Okay.
And when we refuse to listen to people who have different values to us, and we judge that person or that group of people because their values are diametrically opposed to our own and we feel their values are wrong, it becomes very, very difficult to engage in a dialogue of understanding because the judgments that we make about the invalidity of that person's worldview prevent us from deeply listening. And I'd say that's probably at the heart of why we find it hard to get along with people. Because we've already decided what their motivations are. We've already decided their motivations are no good.
Oh,
and
very interesting.
That we will somehow contaminate ourselves if we engage in a dialogue with them.
Okay.
And it's very, very difficult for people who are activists or people who are really passionately trying to help marginalized people. Giving people a voice, regardless of where the power imbalance is really at the heart of what mediation is. It's really giving everybody a voice and everybody a choice in how they want to resolve the shared problem. So when we come up against values clashes, particularly if those values clashes have to do with things like politics.
Bingo.
Oh, yeah.
There's a clash for you.
Particularly politics, I'd say, or things like causes, you know, when people have a sort of a cause orientation, environmental conflicts are historically very, very difficult to resolve because everybody engaged in that conflict has a passionately held value system.
Right.
That's at stake. And the way we are as humans is we don't want to compromise our values, and nor should we. But what happens in mediation is that people frequently see that there actually is no conflict of values. What there ends up being is a conflict in how that value is expressed or implemented. It's the way the person wants that value to be lived that is in conflict, not the actual value itself.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to build new communities across value divides like that, we need to go to what William Urey, who's a great, he's the guy who with Roger Fisher wrote Getting to Yes. He's in the Harvard Negotiation School of Thought and a leader in mediation and conflict resolution thinking.
So it's William Urey and who's
William
the other?
William Urey and Roger Fisher.
And Roger Fisher, Getting to Yes.
But William Urey talks about the third side. He talks about people who are impartial mediators, people who are helping others find consensus, find resolution. He would refer to those people as people of the third side.
Mm.
And he talks about taking people to the balcony. Can I tell a little story?
Wow, the balcony, okay.
Yeah, taking people to the balcony because you need to have that overview.
Mm-hmm.
People in nonviolent communication talk about Marshall Rosenberg, who's the gentleman who created nonviolent communication, talks about taking the giraffe's view.
Mm-hmm.
The giraffe is the land animal with the largest heart.
Mm-hmm.
But the giraffe also has that very nice high perspective and can have an overview of everything.
Right.
And I feel like this is what we have to do when we're feeling like it's an us against them kind of feeling. We need to see if we can take that giraffe view, if we can find the third side
mm-hmm.
as individuals. Because when we do that, we can relax our own hold, our stranglehold on our own position, and we can begin to open ourselves to how things might be for the other person and begin to move a bit closer to understanding. Because without a willingness to understand, we will never be able to communicate effectively, we won't be able to listen without judgment, and we'll never be able really
yes.
to dialogue in a way that can create new community.
And you know, this is and for our listeners, I'm talking to Kate Griffiths, who's the Executive Director of Recourse Mediation Services out of Santa Rosa, California. And we were talking about the value of effective communication and becoming mediators in the new communities as resolving conflict and understanding what's underlying conflict. And, you know, I want to put some oomph into this in saying that, you know, the United States is one of the most heavily armed countries. So when push comes to shove, there are a lot of people ready to shoot first and ask questions later. They're going to need a lot of communicating with.
And they're acting out of their reptilian brain.
The reptilian brain that you mentioned earlier, yes.
Because guns promote, in my opinion, this is my personal opinion,
mm-hmm.
people who are Second Amendment enthusiasts, people
mm-hmm.
who have a strong value, and in fact I mediated a restraining order dispute recently precisely around this issue. Two people, one who was a gun collector and gun aficionado, who resented the fact that his neighbor wanted him to get rid of his guns, and the gentleman on the other side was an anti-gun activist. So you had these people filing restraining orders against each other and taking up the court's time with this.
That's pretty good. Keep this guy away from my gun.
Keep this
guy's gun away from me.
Right, because if you get a restraining order against somebody and you want that to be a restraining order that law enforcement will track, then the guns must be surrendered. Well, this person had spent a long time collecting his guns, and they gave him an identity of sorts.
Right.
So plus, he had this passionately held value that it was a rights-based value, that I have the right to have this, and I feel at risk and vulnerable if I don't have my guns in my home. And the other man's saying, I feel at risk and vulnerable when you have your guns in your home.
Yeah, really.
We ended up, thank goodness for the two extremely talented attorneys on each side here, but we ended up with an agreement because we found a creative way of letting the gentleman keep ownership of his guns but not access to them during the and agreements about where he could use them in other counties well away from this person.
Very interesting.
Even in that sort of a situation, it's possible to find ways to respect each other's value, recognize that you're not going to change somebody else's value, but still get what you need. The person who had the serious anti-gun aversion needed a feeling of personal safety. It's a primary human need. He also needed his position to be respected, his value to be respected and acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, the person on the other side, he felt that as an American, having somebody take away his Second Amendment right was a violation of his constitutional rights. He was very passionate about that. But he also recognized that if he was obstinate, what would happen would be he would lose ownership of his guns.
Right, right.
Which was a serious interest for him. What we do in mediation is try and help people peel back why what they think they want is important to them. Because if you keep asking, why is that important to you? Why is that important to you?
Mm-hmm.
You will get to the underlying needs and concerns and desires and fears. If we can all dialogue with each other based on those fundamental interests, we will understand each other's point of view a little bit better than if we ascribe motivations that are probably incorrect.
So if I may point it out to the listeners and pull that out of our dialogue here, why is that important to you is a fundamental question.
Yeah, because it's an inquiry that is fundamentally respectful. What you're trying to do is find out from that person what their motivation is. You're not going to guess about it. So if you respectfully say to somebody, I am having a difficult time understanding why you're fighting so passionately for this outcome that you want,
mm-hmm.
please help me understand why that's so important to you. And if you do that in a respectful way, as humans, all we want is to be heard and understood, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and that's like a way of saying, you know, I acknowledge you, your value as a human being enough that I'm going to ask you this and listen to your response.
Right. And when you do that, what you find is that you will receive it back.
Mm.
The other person will behave respectfully to you. Now, I'm sure there are people out there saying, oh, yeah, what about all those nutcases? Well, look, you know, there are always going to be a percentage of people in any community who have difficulties, either whether they are mental health difficulties, personality disorders, substance abuse, all of those kinds of things that inhibit a person from sharing a reality with the majority of other people. There's always going to be those people. But when I deal with those people at the court, for example, I consider it an exercise for me in how to extend myself to understand somebody. And they still have a right to be heard. They still have, as Simone Weil, who was a great philosopher, said, the only obligation we have to each other is respect. So even if somebody's crazy or a little bit unable to join the reality that the rest of us share, they still live in our community and they still deserve to be heard. And if we can try and do it, understood.
Yes. The greatest obligation we have for each other is respect.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's the only. Simone Weil, I think you pronounce her name, Weil.
Mm-hmm.
She said that's our only obligation to each other.
Our only obligation to each other is respect. Wow. And, you know, I have a story to impart, which was I went off on a camping trip, but it was probably two summers ago, up into the Sierra foothills and was on a large multifamily camping trip, and I was not actually part of any of the families. I just got invited. It was a friend of a friend. And there were some other people. I'm involved with the Sierra Club, and there were some other people from the Sierra Club there. And there were also all these politically conservative people there
mm-hmm.
on the campout. And it was like I found myself seated around the campfire next to somebody who was part of the Tea Party and who had actually been running for office as a Tea Party conservative. And here I am, you know, Sierra Club, blah blah blah. You know, I'm the environmentalist of the. One of the environmentalists of the group, I guess. And, you know, there was the usual little, you know, jibing about, oh, well, are you driving a Prius and mm-hmm. doing the right thing for the environment and global warming and that in kind of a sarcastic manner. And what I found is that there were two things that occurred to me. One was, this is really what the new community looks like. It's
right.
got everybody in it.
Right.
And, like, actually, in the new community, you'd have brown people, you'd have people speaking Spanish, you'd have people speaking, you know, Fijian. I mean, you'd have some very dark people in addition to white people
mm-hmm.
In the new community. But you'd also have these conservative people and people with guns, and you'd have all kinds of people
right.
that kind of get who live here.
Right.
You know, we all live here. And so I had this wonderful opportunity to be in a dialogue
mm.
with somebody who I normally maybe I would have avoided or certainly mm-hmm. avoided having any sort of a conversation about politics or environment. We actually came away from both of us in agreement that that subsidies to oil companies and coal companies are very non-productive
right.
based on that really don't produce any outcome for the amount of money that's given.
Right.
And that is totally unnecessary, not needed based on, you know, why should the government be be handing out welfare like that. Mm-hmm. So we kind of both came to this agreement around that on the
and
same principle.
It sounds like that surprised you a bit.
And it did actually surprise me, but it all came from, like, there's really nothing wrong with the guy for believing what he believes, and he just happens
right.
to believe what he believes. I wonder if there's anything they have in common.
Well, that's the ability, which is actually a sign of personal maturity, the ability to suspend judgment and be able to listen to people. And this is where I think what we're going to have to do as human beings is take personal responsibility for our own maturity level. And personal responsibility is not very popular in our culture. If you just looked at how many frivolous lawsuits or how much out of control bad behavior, immature behavior you see from so-called celebrities, that sort of thing, we have lost our picture of what it looks like to be a successful human being, I think. All of the social systems that used to give us guidance there, organized religion, for example, if you talk about back in the days of the bubonic plague, people had frames of reference that gave them some predictability about what they could expect from life and
yeah.
how
and from
what
Almighty
meaning
God.
They could give to life, right?
Right.
So it's very difficult now because all of those systems have lost ground, and even science, which tends, in my opinion, to be a sort of way of looking at the world that most people can get on board with, even science has its own limitations in terms of being able to help people find frames of reference, and also the way science is practiced and the way scientific studies are conducted and that sort of thing. We don't have as much trust in those kinds of things as we used to.
Right.
And I think all of these things for me points to, we really have to strip this back to fundamentals, and we have to retrieve our power to be responsible for our own consciousness and our own evolution and our own development. And although that's not terribly popular, I don't see how we're going to survive as a species without doing that. And part of our responsibility is to each other. So if we start intrapersonally and we start not being so cruel and judgmental to ourselves, because isn't this what we do?
Yeah,
we're
right,
very,
right.
We castigate ourselves, we rake ourselves over the coals, we hold ourselves up to impossible standards, we berate ourselves for failing, and we're not patient with our own growth or our own way of learning. If we're trying to make change and we're trying to learn how to do something differently, we're trying to break bad habits, if we don't do that well intrapersonally, we're not going to be able to do it very well interpersonally, and we're not going to be able to do it very well on a community level. So I'd say anybody who wants to know where to start, you know that lovely expression, think globally, act locally.
Yes.
I would take it act intrapersonally.
It doesn't even get more local than inside your own head.
It doesn't get too much more local than that. And I think that people recognize how harshly they judge themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you shouldn't be surprised if you then judge other people harshly. But
so
that's where we have to start, I think.
So Kate Griffiths, Executive Director of Recourse Mediation Services, would you recommend then to people that maybe rather than listening to that voice in their head that's castigating themselves, that they listen, at least devote some time and effort to listening to the people who are telling them that they've got something right? And
oh, you're absolutely right, Dan.
Okay.
Yeah. Find people in your life who can see you accurately and who care about you and who are not too negative, and just find a way to appreciate what is good, because I think there's so much good in the world and there's so much good in the current situation. We tend to be quite pessimistic about it and we overlook it. There are more outbreaks of peace in the world than there are of hostility. They're just underreported.
They're just underreported, yeah.
So if we notice the outbreaks of peace in ourselves, and we notice the moments of joy, and we notice the moments of appreciation and validation and those kinds of things, and we start there, we can begin to validate and acknowledge other people, even if we don't like them.
Yes.
And that's where we can begin to become interested in people, interested in the evolution of the community,
mm-hmm.
and interested
that's
in actual authentic communication with each other.
That's great. That's
and
great.
I'd invite anybody who wants to learn how to become a mediator to get onto the National Association for Community Mediation website. That's N for Nancy, N-A-F for Frank, C-M. org, and find a community mediation organization near you and see if you can train to be a community mediator. And you'll find that, as our mediators, volunteer mediators do, that it's very addicting helping other people when there's nothing in it for you.
Wow. So that could be an activity for a reskilling for people moving into developing and creating the new communities.
Yes.
Something I'm pulling out of something of what you were saying here, Kate, is strip back to the fundamentals and return to our own power.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hearing that in all of this that you've been saying, and it certainly is what being a shift shaper is all about. And so I am going to thank you for joining us here on Shift Shapers, both on KBBF FM and also on our podcast on Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio. Great ideas that you brought here, and definitely people look at that NAMCM.org.
NAF.
Oh,
it's the National Association for Community Mediation.
For
so
community.
NAFCM.
Okay. NAF is in Frank.
Correct.
CM.org.
Correct.
NAFACMA.org. Okay. And that's for the National Association of.
For
Community Mediators.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I get on there, I will find out and get this and have this thing. I'll get it right.
Well, I so appreciate the opportunity, Dan. You're doing great work, and I really encourage all of your listeners to keep shifting their own shape and to find a way to be the change they want to see in the world.
Absolutely.
As Gandhi would say.
Absolutely.
Because that's it all comes from being, and then after being, we go ahead and do.
It's going to take.
If we try and do first, we sometimes mess ourselves up.
Ah, okay. Be first and then do. Yes. Mm. It's going to take a lot of Gandhis, I think, coming up here. So
we're all Gandhis.
We're all Gandhis in there.
Yeah.
So Kate Griffiths, definitely. Again, I appreciate your time, and I've been talking with Executive Director Kate Griffiths, who's the Executive Director of Recourse Mediation Services, a community-based mediation service out of Santa Rosa, California. And you are listening to Shift Shapers, Pole Reversal Radio.